ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly wrap of global news in arts and culture. I'm Daniel Browning. Last week, a fourth investigation into the APY Arts Centre Collective finished, once again finding no wrongdoing. This week, we'll look at the impact that story's had on the people involved. I'll pay tribute to a great musician, the creator of one of this country's first protest albums, recorded inside one of Australia's toughest jails. And we head out to the Perth Festival at a major new site for art in that city. But first, the headlines with Skye Kirkham. Now, Skye, we begin with a shocking decision by Creative Australia.
Earlier this week, the artist Khaled Sotsabi and curator Michael D'Agostino were announced as Australia's representatives for the 2026 Venice Biennale. But after reporting by News Limited Papers and questions from the opposition in Question Time that was critical of Sotsabi's earlier work, the Board of Creative Australia has made a unanimous decision to cancel that selection. In a statement, they've said Creative Australia is an advocate for freedom of artistic expression and is not an adjudicator on the interpretation of art. However, the board believes a prolonged and divisive debate about the 2026 election outcome poses an unacceptable risk to public support for Australia's artist community. Since then, the other five shortlisted artists and curators have released a statement together asking for the reinstatement of Khaled and Michael. The statement says, "We believe that revoking support for the current Australian artist and curator representative for Venice Biennale 2026 is antithetical to the goodwill and hard-fought artistic independence, freedom of speech and moral courage that is at the core of arts in Australia, which plays a crucial role in our thriving and democratic nation."
What a huge story. And none of those artists, the shortlisted artists, have indicated a willingness to take up that spot left by Khaled and Michael. That's the story we'll be following up on in more detail next week on Arts in 30. But now, a major Prince documentary won't be making its way to audiences as well.
A 9-hour documentary directed by the Academy Award-winning director Ezra Edelman has been in trouble since last year when the singer's estate made a series of demands for cuts and reshoots. According to Netflix, the Prince estate and Netflix have come to a mutual agreement that will allow the estate to develop and produce a new documentary featuring exclusive content from Prince's archive. As a result, the Netflix documentary will not be released. When the project began 5 years ago, Edelman was told that the estate wouldn't exert any editorial control. But control of the estate has changed since then, as has management at Netflix.
And US President Donald Trump has his eyes set on another job, chair of the Kennedy Center.
The National Cultural Center is home to the National Symphony and the Washington Opera. It's one of the leading art institutions in America. But Donald Trump isn't happy. After terminating the role of a large number of board members and quickly installing replacements, Trump has been, quote, unanimously confirmed as chair of the centre. Shonda Rhimes, Ben Folds and Renee Fleming have all resigned from their positions with the organisation since then, and Issa Rae is one of several artists to cancel a show there. Prior to this, the Kennedy Center's leaders had received a letter from two Republican congressmen accusing the center of subsidizing Chinese Communist Party propaganda because they had presented performances by the National Ballet of China.
Wow, one of the world's most celebrated ballet companies. What have you got for us in terms of quick hits?
Well, Anora was a surprising but, I will say, deserving winner of Best Picture at the Critics' Choice Awards, while Demi Moore and Adrian Brody took out the acting awards, and John M. Chu won Best Director for his work on Wicked. Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, went on an extended anti-Semitic rant on social media during which he referred to himself as a Nazi and praised Adolf Hitler. He also purchased a Super Bowl ad which directed people to Yeezy.com. As at recording, that site is selling only one product, a t-shirt featuring a swastika.
Oh my God, I know he left the planet a long time ago, but this is just unbelievable. Some news from home.
Yes, Creative Australia has announced a commitment of $800,000 over 4 years for a new national body, Creative Climate, which will assist artists and organisations to transition from a carbon economy and adapt to the impacts of climate change. Also, a Bryan Adams concert was cancelled at the last minute in Perth by the state's water corporation because of, quote, a large blockage of fat, grease and rags, which created a risk of wastewater backing up within the toilet venues. Not what you ever want to hear.
That is gross.
The MSO have announced their new chair, Edgar Meyer. Meyer takes over from David Lee, who spent 12 years in the role, and the changes to the board come less than 6 months after the managing director, Sophie Galais, left the company following a vote of no confidence from the orchestra's musician. And a couple of valets. Tom Robbins, the American author of 8 novels, including Jitterbug Perfume and Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, has passed away at the age of 92. And Irv Gotti, the music producer and co-founder of Murder, Inc. Records, has died at the age of 54. And that's the arts news that's current as of Friday, the 14th of February.
I'm Daniel Browning and you're listening to Arts in 30 on ABC Radio National. Last week on the show, I spoke to Gabriella Kozlovich about the claims against the APY Arts Centre Collective and the 4 investigations which have all returned without finding any wrongdoing by that organisation. But what was the cost for the organisations and the people who were caught up in the allegations? When The Australian newspaper raised concerns about the authorship of the artworks coming out of the thriving industry centred in the APY lands in the far north of South Australia, ramping up to almost daily coverage of the affair, it led to the cancellation of a major exhibition. Noora Pulka was the name of that exhibition, and it was the work of my guest, Bruce Johnson-McLean, former head curator, First Nations Art, at the National Gallery of Australia. Bruce, welcome. You were in that role for 5 years. You'd filled other roles prior to that before moving to Canberra from Brisbane, where you worked at the Queensland Art Gallery. Why precisely did you decide to walk?
Yeah, obviously the cancellation of Noora Pulka was a huge factor in deciding to leave the National Gallery. You know, that was really a dream job on paper. But my entire working career has really been focused on supporting artists, working with artists to tell their stories and get their messages out to the world. And through this entire saga and, I guess, culminating with the cancellation of Noora Pulka, the artists, I think, were not supported. And that sort of went against everything that I've worked towards in my career. I did stay on for some time after the decision to at least postpone the exhibition. And, you know, there was always hope, and I think there still is hope, that the exhibition could still happen at the National Gallery. But the entire saga really took a toll on, you know, not just me, and I really don't want to make this about me. I think there's been enough people doing that already, you know, but it really took its toll on the artists, you know, having to talk to the artists throughout this period to hear the impacts on themselves, on their communities, you know, on the industry. That's obviously taken its toll on a lot of people, not just me. And, you know, I think that through this, it's also, it showed me that museums aren't really equipped for leadership in the arts either. They're quite fine when things are going well, but whenever there's a crisis, they will recede into their shells and hide behind governance and these sorts of walls.
Bruce, were you surprised at how quickly the investigation was called and how quickly the NGA backed away from just a, you know, carte blanche decision to support the artists and to believe what they were saying and to believe what the APYACC was saying? And to kind of like to be cowed by, I guess, the Australian's coverage of the affair.
Yeah, I think that the media really wields a lot of power far beyond the sort of
what they should.
Yeah, absolutely.
they shouldn't wield that kind of power in the art world.
Their reach and their impact, their impression on the public far exceeds public institutions. So, you know, the National Gallery, I guess, and all institutions will do what they believe is right in terms of, you know, they'll do what's right.
Their face. Yeah. They'll save face.
Absolutely. And that's kind of, you know, what most institutions, businesses, any sort of organisation will do. But, you know, for me personally, you know, that was just something that didn't obviously sit well with me. But in terms of, you know, how quickly it happened, I think that there was an overall intention to support the artists, but the power, I guess, of the media and the story that blew up, the secondary impacts of that, the way that an institution's programs, acquisitions, other things can be called into question as a collateral from this story, the gallery kind of does get backed into a corner of needing to act. So I think that even if an institution has the best intentions in that sort of situation, the power that the media wields over, you know, wanting to support artists and do the right thing kind of wins out. So I'm not blaming the gallery for retreating into that position.
It's systemic, isn't
it? It's just problem. A part of the way that power is wielded, where it's wielded, and who it's very easily wielded against. And Aboriginal people are a very, very easy target. And we, particularly with the background of a referendum for a voice for Aboriginal people, I guess this was a really great example of the way that Aboriginal people can be disempowered, their voice can be taken away. And, you know, it really did feel like this was a point being made by that conservative media to try to destroy something that was Aboriginal, that was successful, and to really kind of stamp that authority. And, you know, for me personally, you know, I don't like being in those situations where you're attached to an institution where then you kind of also have your voice taken away. You become compromised. So I think externally being independent to a degree, being based on the outside and being able to, you know, engage in discussions like this is really important. And being able to, again, show support for artists and art and community is really important. So I guess those are the reasons that I really took that decision to step outside of not just the National Gallery, but I guess museums more broadly.
Well, you've left the institutional art world. I mean, you're now an independent curator. And do you see what kind of prospects for you for the future do you see as an independent curator working in this space?
Oh, really, really great. You know, I've never wanted to make this about me because you know, I think this is
no. But I'm interested in how much of a career you can have outside an institution.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there are huge opportunities. I mean, one of the most disheartening things about the Nurrupulka exhibition was that, you know, there was interest. Really strong interest being shown in that exhibition and those works internationally. There is a real interest in Aboriginal art internationally, not just here in this country. So the fact that it was brought down in this way took away incredible opportunities for those artists, for those communities, for the industry at large. Some of them would have been the biggest opportunities for any Australian artist ever. And yet that was so easily eroded by the media here at home. So for me, you know, working as an independent curator, I have the freedom to work with institutions, with international institutions, with collectors, with really major collectors internationally. And, you know, I think, you know, it's a space where, you know, I believe I can still really support artists and support communities, but also gives me the flexibility to do that in multiple ways that I hope will communities compromise myself or the artists.
Thank you so much, Bruce, and thanks for adding your personal perspective here on Arts in 30.
Thanks, Daniel.
That's the now independent curator and writer, Bruce Johnson-McLean. On Radio National, you're listening to Arts in 30, your weekly wrap of global news in arts and culture. I'm Daniel Browning. From the Tate Modern in London to Sydney's White Bay and the Brisbane Powerhouse, converted power stations have become some of the most interesting venues for art in major cities across the world. The Perth Festival's just begun for another year, and they're joining the tradition with a new site for art and music at the East Perth Power Station, with the building itself becoming a canvas for First Nations artists as part of Borloo Contemporary. Anna Reese is the Artistic Director of the Perth Festival. Anna, how did you end up getting access to the power station?
Well, look, it was actually slightly easier than I had anticipated. I mean, when you become Artistic Director, you know, you always have a very long list of hopes and dreams and very large ambitions. And look, we began with the state government, who were very open and enthusiastic of us looking into the idea. And from then on, honestly, doors just opened. It's been an incredible collaboration, a true collaboration, really, between state government, local government, the immediate residents of the East Perth Power Station. And, just really kind of incredible supporters.
Now, metaphorically speaking, take us out to the site. What was it like when you first visited, and how has it changed for the festival?
Well, when we went down to the site for the first time, I mean, the East Perth Power Station, the architecture is just extraordinary. You know, it's incredibly industrial. It was very overrun with lots of greenery, lots of weeds, lots of different kinds of plants. And out the front was quite a dust bowl, actually. But the building itself, in terms of our takeover, hasn't really changed. So we've utilized the front of the building and created a fantastic big community space, you know, lots of lights and an incredible big stage for world music, lovely food, lovely drink. But it's when you walk around the back of the power station. We walked down there for the first time, walked into this indoor-outdoor space where you're completely dwarfed by these huge, huge facades of the building, and you feel really dwarfed by it, but you're under the stars, you know, you're kind of in the balmy summer of Western Australia, and that's where we've created our new contemporary music venue around the back. So you go down to the Swan River, this very, very lush setting. Everything's open. There's beautiful grass there now. But when you go around the back, you're transferred into something that's, you know, it's inspired a bit by the London Print Works and by, you know, Shine Nightclub in Belfast. But it is what it is. It's huge and full of character and full of Perth's history.
Now, for this year, only the outside of the site's accessible. You're going to have Borloo Contemporary, which is a First Nations artist exhibition. Tell me about a little bit about the artists and, you know, what Borloo Contemporary actually is.
Borloo Contemporary is a brand new initiative for Perth Festival, which is committed to commissioning our extraordinary First Nations artists from across Western Australia. So we have commissioned a number of really brilliant artists to do all kinds of work. Some are exhibited in galleries and some are large site-specific installations. Down at the East Perth Power Station, as part of Borloo Contemporary, we have the East Perth Power Station Commission. And so we have commissioned three wonderful Noongar artists across three different generations, Alan Urens, Alona Maguire, and Daniel Hansen. And they have created work specifically in response to the site of the power station, to the country that lies beneath it, to the history, to the politics. Alan Urens' work is this phenomenal kind of almost hypercolor landscapes of what the country used to look like before the power station was even there. So when you go down to the power station site, the whole front side and around another side of the power station are completely covered in beautiful projections that are animated, that move, you know, water that moves, trees that sway, frogs that jump. It's a very beautiful, very special celebration of culture and country on that side.
And the fact that it once powered the entire state, you know, you think of Western Australia, the biggest state, it's bigger than many countries. But powering the entire state from that site in East Perth, and now, you know, this opportunity to electrify a contemporary art and culture, It's a beautiful kind of round thought, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's a very, I think it's a really wonderful story, actually, about when that wing I just mentioned opened in 1931, this final wing of the power station. There was this whole setup, actually, between London and Perth, because of course, back then, everything, you know, in Australia kind of supposedly came from the United Kingdom. This whole event was staged where the politicians in London and our politicians in Western Australia.
Oh my God, it was a simulcast.
Well, basically, where London switched on the power for the East Perth power station. And our politicians stood in front of our power station with a sign that said success to the new power station. And when London switched on the power, the sign lit up. Huh. And so we have this wonderful, you know, kind of tribute to that. You see some projections on our power station and a big fluoro light installation which says success to the new power station. It's a bit of tongue-in-cheek, but it's a classic kind of Australian story of that era, really.
Beautiful. That's Anna Reese, the Artistic Director of the Perth Festival. I want to acknowledge the passing of Uncle Vic Sims, who went from child star to jailbird. It was while the Bidjigal fella from Sydney's La Perouse community was serving a prison sentence that he produced the most extraordinary album, one of the unacknowledged gems of Australian music. The Loner was that album, recorded inside the notorious Bathurst Jail, and which not long after erupted into riots once again. In 2007, I was presenting and producing Away, the Indigenous Art and Culture program. And my co-producer managed to get Uncle Vic and his band into an RN studio to record fresh new versions of two classic tracks, including this one, Get Back Into the Shadows.
The air was thick from smoking. A froggy said, hey boy, get out. I said, you must be joking. Well, I sat up near the group that played. The sound was loud and tinny. Yeah, I was mama's dark-haired boy. I was a brown-eyed pickaninny. And this joint was fine, it blew my mind. I just got down to grooving. Then I looked around. This man who said, hey boy, get moving. He said, if you're brown, stick brown. And if you're white, it's alright. And if you're black, hey, you get back into the shadows.
And for more on Uncle Vic's legacy, check out the next episode of Away with Rudy Bremer or The Music Show with Andrew Ford. I'm Daniel Browning and you're listening to Arts in 30 on ABC Radio National. Every week here on Arts in 30, I'm joined by a music aficionado from across the ABC's music networks to bring you the one track you should be adding, our track of the week. And this week, Taj Aldeeb from ABC Classic joins me. Taj, welcome. Please surprise me. What do you got?
I've got Golden Heart by Dawn Richard.
Now, the first in a trilogy of albums, I understand?
I believe so, and it is quite an outstanding song. It has Claire de Lune as the music, with this R&B artist from America just singing on top. So it's quite a duality of a kind. And the music is a very known piece by Debussy, who apparently he hated it when he was writing it before we released it at some point when a publisher convinced him to do so and became one of his most popular pieces of all time. You hear it everywhere, Daniel, absolutely everywhere. Dawn decided to write some lyrics for it.
I love Claire de Lune, Light of the Moon, isn't it? Yeah, it's beautiful.
Absolutely.
Why is this the one that we should be listening to? What makes it so special, do you reckon?
I mean, Claire de Lune by itself on its own is probably one of my favorite pieces. I feel like anyone could listen to it as accompaniment to any emotion, like sad, angry, longing, nostalgic, angry, whatever you feel like. There will be something in there. Clair de Lune, it's like, I don't know, all the cycles of the moon. And also, if you're a wolf, you can just listen to it and go howl at night. Like, this is all the reasons for you to do so. But also, you got Dawn Richard singing on top. Like, she's pushing boundaries, and this is the time for it.
And we love this crossover of, you know, of pop and classical, where classical really comes into its own, and it just reaches beyond its audience to ever younger generation, and crossing over, I think, is where a lot of classical music for me has really had high impact.
Absolutely. And this is the kind of music that will kind of keep living and living in different ways and reshaped by the people who are coming in and listening to it. And then whoever is listening to it will take whatever they want to take from it. So the moment that usually an artist kind of releases something, it's not theirs anymore in some way. It is also the listeners. So you can take from it what you wish.
Taj, thank you for being my guest here on Arts in 30. Can you throw to the track for us?
Absolutely. This is Golden Heart by Dawn Richard and Debussy.
White eyes, not scared to fly. That's what we were young, you are. When love was speechless, and hearts can be broken.
That was Taj Aldeeb's pick for Track of the Week. It was Golden Heart, performed by Dawn Richard. That's all we have time for here on Arts in 30. Thanks to producer Sky Kirkham, executive producer C. Benedict, and sound engineer Matthew Crawford. I'm Daniel Browning. I'll catch you next time.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.